We're going to continue on the topic of trying to understand when it is that halakha changes, according to what criteria. Hopefully by now it's clear that halakha does change. Right? We often hear a slogan that halakha doesn't, and there's perhaps something that's meant by that, but we often forget what that means. We speak about Torah being unchanging, and it's true that the Torah in both written and oral forms had a set content. But halakha is any living legal system has to be applied to different situations. And those situations have something to do with place and time. Not every place is the same, and not every time is the same. And today we're basically going to give all sorts of examples and try to organize a way of thinking as to when does halakha change. I want to preface by referring back to a question that Binyamin asked at the end of the last class, which I'm not really going to answer right now, but I hope to answer or at least address later on in the next couple weeks. And that was the issue of kitniyot on Pesach. Right? He asked, you know, kitniyot is a minhag. It's not really, it's certainly not from Chazal. It's later than Chazal, so already we don't have the impediment, the legal impediment that you need a Beit Din to rescind it. And the reason for it doesn't seem to apply today. I mean, we could think of other examples. In fact, we saw that, at least according to the Ran, we should be making Kiddush in Beit Knesset, even though the original reason doesn't apply. And if no Takana exists there, so that also is problematic. And there's going to be cases where the reason no longer applies, and it would seem that we should do away with the law according to the patterns that we have seen, that we're going to be seeing. Obviously, I mean, it should be clear that there are certain places where rabbinic laws that are not, the reason of which is no longer applicable, are taken off the books, or at least by some poskim taken off the books. And there are cases when they're not taken off the books. And there's not going to be clear-cut guidelines as to when they are and when they're not. I think there are guidelines. Obviously, it's going to depend who we're speaking about. But I think they're definitely going to be seeing patterns. Those of you who read carefully the article of Professor Steinberg from Shari Tzedek about Shinui Teva, right, when nature is different, already he's talking about some ideas, some guidelines. I think it's the section Dalit, where he speaks more generally about the topic. He already is giving some guidelines as to when certain poskim are changing, when other poskim are not changing. You're also going to see much more clearly in the article that I'm going to give you today by Rev. Aaron Lichtenstein, which is on the syllabus also about social factors in Psak Halacha. Right, so we'll be moving more in that direction in the next couple of weeks, both in your readings and in the classes. So I will address that, but I'm putting on the side for right now. Right now we're just going to gather more information to sort of fill our stomach, so to speak, with what we refer to as Torah, the basar, you know, the meat of the topic, to actually see it, even though there's so many sources that we're just going to be touching the surface, and even in the sources that we're going to see, they too will only be handled somewhat superficially. I apologize for that, but that's simply the nature of the time frame. We don't have much time to do it. I would strongly recommend anybody who's interested in the topic to look through all the sources yourself that we give, and even do further research. The Seder. So just to remind you that we spoke about two strategies of abrogating rabbinic halakha, because we said that the rabbinic halakha, plainly seen as approached by mainstream poskim who are not concerned about nistar, about Kabbalistic reasons why we shouldn't be playing with any type of laws. But mainstream poskim have an issue, in fact, as mentioned in that article also, that a rabbinic law is on the books and there's certain technical problems of taking such laws off the books. So we said there were two ways around this problem with rabbinic law. And we're talking about dinei derabbanan, we're not talking about laws that are stemming from the Torah, they're deraita. One was to say that the law was never really legislated. It was a hanhaga, it was something that was taken on, it was the result of the conclusion of a discussion, but was never formulated as law per se. Right? The problem, the big problem with that, as we mentioned, is that the Gemara is really not clear. It's not a statute, a code of law where everything is set neatly and carefully, and you know what's a law and what's a minhag, and never the twain shall meet. So that's going to be a more difficult approach, and we see it rarely. We saw it in the late Rishonim. We saw it in terms of this discussion about Kiddush. As far as the Beit Yosef was concerned, Kiddush on Friday night in Shul. In any case, the more popular avenue, and this is what we're going to expand tonight, is to say that even if there was a takana, the takana did not apply to the situation that we're dealing with. And again, given that situations change, that's something that is fairly intuitive. It's a fairly intuitive way to say, well, you know, the rabbis had a certain mitzvah, they had a certain reality, or what I call realia, in front of them. Now we have a completely different reality. That's not what they had in mind at all. They had the intention to prohibit just exactly the situation that was in front of them. The most, I shouldn't say the truth is, I'm going to break this down into two categories, physical realia and social realia. Obviously, social realia is going to be trickier. We'll speak about it in the second part of the class. Physical realia is fairly straightforward in the sense that what you see is not what Chazal are describing. This breaks down into two areas, one which is simpler than the other. One is technological realia, meaning that the stove of 2,000 years ago is not the same stove as we have today. And this may have ramifications in terms of halacha. You want to ask something?
If it's okay, yeah. I apologize if I missed something. I'm not sure I got the distinction between those two things.
Physical and social?
No, that's not.
Teva, natural, then. Sorry?
Like the way that we can do away with the takana that you mentioned last week and the way that we talked about this.
Right, so. I mentioned there's two strategies. One is to say there was no such law at all. In other words, let's go back to our example last week. Kiddush in Beit Knesset on Leil Shabbat. Okay, so the Beit Yosef says, you know, there was never such a law. Jews did do that, and the Gemara spoke about it, but there was no formalized law.
There was never a takana.
That's right. That's correct. That's correct.
I understand that with everything.
Correct. And as I said, it's very rare. The truth is, you can say it with everything, but that's precisely the problem. Because very rarely is something defined as a takana in the Gemara. So once you say that, you open up this giant Pandora's box. And there's more than Pandora's box. There's really no way of determining it. So you're on very thin ground. So that's why today we're going to talk about something that was much more popular, to say that, obviously, in the case of Kiddush, you can't say the Kiddush is the same Kiddush. There's no difference in the realia, one would imagine. But in any case, the discussion we're talking about today right now is that the object that's involved or the scenario that's involved is not the same scenario that the rabbis were confronting when they made the law. And as I said, the area that we're going to start with, which is more straightforward, is physical reality. Again, that breaks down into two categories, that the natural differences, which is going to be more problematic, we'll explain why in a couple of minutes, but first, more straightforward, is technology being different, okay? So I gave you an example to look at about that, fairly straightforward, right? We're talking about reading with the Shabbos candles on Friday night, or even Shabbat day, if you have a dark room and you have long enough candle, so, right? So, it's the Gemara says it's prohibited, right? Why is it prohibited? Who knows? If you saw the Gemara, if it was clear enough from the Shulchan Aruch, what's the problem? Okay, you might tip it. What are you going to tip? you're gonna be and why are you gonna tip? What are you gonna tip and why are you gonna tip it?
If it's not giving off a good enough light, then you would tip it to bring it closer.
Tip what? What's it?
The holder of the oil.
Okay, right. So the technology is you have a wick, right? I mean, if you say from Hanukkah, most of us are familiar. In Israel, we use oil, so we all know what it looks like, right? You have a bowl with oil. You have a wick, right, going into the oil. So apparently, the oils were not as good, as well refined as they are today, and certainly the holders were often more coarse. In any case, oftentimes the light from the flame, the wick wasn't dipping into the oil properly, and the wick was flickering. Okay, so if you're in the middle of a very exciting suspense novel, right, and you're looking over on Shabbat night, and your light starts flickering, so what are you going to do? You're not paying attention to the light. You're going to do what you do during the rest of the week, and in that situation, that's your light. So what do? You tip the oil, you just like when there's not enough water in the bottom of a hot water boiler, so you flip it over to get the water. So you flip your nair, right, your receptacle, so that more oil will hit the wick, and you're happy and you're able to read, right? So that's the problem, and that's why we don't read or on there on Leil Shabbat. Okay, that was in their times, right? Comes along, and it's very interesting discussion. The Gemara, I don't know if anybody saw it. The Gemara says this is true also if the light were several stories high. Right? In other words, even if it was several stories, remember the problem is you're going to tip the wick. You're going to play around with the wick, and you're going to cause this is an isur doraita, because when you put oil to the wick, what are you doing? You're doing a havara. You're creating a fire, right? So the Gemara says, but you know what? The halacha is the same halacha even if the wick is two stories up. Right? Two stories up means what? What's the implication?
Can't reach it.
Okay. So what's the explanation? So Rashi's explanation is lo plug. Right? What's lo plug mean? There's certain laws that the Gemara decided to enact even when the situation is not present. Okay. So I don't know if you realize that obviously makes the way out much more difficult. Right. If the whole issue is the reason. Right, so if the reason's not there, we may be able to find a way out. But if we have the Gemara saying that it doesn't make a difference whether the reason of the fear that we're concerned about applies or not, we're still going to prohibit it, so it would seem to close the door on permitting any similar situation. And this is the way it's brought down the Shulchan Aruch, right? That it makes no difference, even if it's two stories up, that the rabbis made the same law in either situation, comes along the Mishnah Berurah and says, however, it doesn't apply with our technology. Right, what's his technology? Shava, but not any Shava, right? If you see in the earlier poskim, candles, wax candles also weren't so well put together. And apparently, you can have similar problems. Not the exact same problems, but you can have similar problems. So, in the time of the Rishonim, wax candles were out also. Comes along the Mishnah Berurah, right? He speaks about a Stern light. I don't know if that means anything to anyone. Means something? What is a Stern light?
Stern light is it's hanging up there.
Uh-huh.
And it's like a candle. It makes on the roof or on the ceiling, it makes a star.
Okay. So for whatever reason, I don't think it's because it looks like a star, but it appears that similar to our candles today, you light it and you forget it, right? It's not there's no problem that you are going to play with the candle when the light flickers, because when it flickers, it goes out. It's not the light. And then it continues to light until it's done lighting. So the Mishnah Berurah, that's not a problem. Right? Why is it not a problem? What does he say over there? Anybody remember? What's that? now it's time. So that you have a computer. So it says Logazru Bazaar. Said the rabbis never had this in mind. They never included, it's true, they had in mind any type of light that flickers, right? Whether it's two stories up and you can't reach it, but a candle, a wax candle that never flickers, is not the same animal as an oil light that does. It's simply a completely different category. And therefore, the rabbis aren't talking about it. In other words, it's similar, it's true, it's similar, but halachically, it may as well be, you know, something completely different. Okay, so this is the Mishnah Berurah. The Aruch HaShulchan, by the way, says something very similar about the kerosene lamps of his time. He's not talking about candles, interestingly enough. But he talks about kerosene lamps, and he says the same thing, that they would work impeccably. Again, I don't have enough background with kerosene lamps. But impeccably, it says that all they do is they burn up the oil. The oil, I don't know, maybe there's a V-shape at the bottom that, you know, the wick goes right to the oil and nothing but the oil. And therefore, it burns to the last drop and then it extinguishes itself. In which case, says the Aruch HaShulchan, that they're also, the rabbis didn't have this in mind. They're two lamps, they're both oil lamps, but they're different types of oil lamps. Okay? And so says the Aruch HaShulchan, they're also on the same siman, which is, it's on your Mari Mekomot, but it's Reish Ayin He, right? Which is Ra'ah, but you probably notice it's not written Ra'ah, but rather Ayin Reish He, right? Very, very nice in the Shulchan Aruch, you never have anything bad. Ra also. It's not written as Ra in the Shulchan Aruch. In any case, that's Mishnah Berurah of Katan Dalet over there, and it's based on the Gemara and Shabbat, Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet. Okay? The other more place I had you look was in Moed Katan, right? Moed Katan, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet. Right, what was talking about over there? I actually did an entire research paper on this once when I was in graduate school, believe it or not. I don't know how good it was, but I did put in pictures. Right, what's it about? What's it over there? Kfiyat Amita. What's Kfiyat Amita? Well, no one knows because we don't do it. Right, but what's from the Gemara Moed Katan? If you know anything about what Moed Katan discusses, you would know even if you hadn't prepared. Well, what does Moed Katan speak about? Yeah. Achol HaMoed as well as Avelus. It's one or the other, right? So that means you have to make a lucky guess, and since you're prepared, you know that it's which one? Avelus, right? Very good. Okay? Put you on the spot. Right? In any case, Chaf Aleph on Bet speaks about various practices. And in it, Tosfot said, Eilat Varim, right, that was the correction in the email, Amud Aleph, right, Chaf Aleph, Amud Aleph. And Tosfot explains to us why we don't do this practice. What's this practice? Kfiyat Amita, Kashmo Kenhu, what does it mean? Likfot Mita. What's Likfot? To flip over a bed. So one of the things they would do is they would flip over their bed and sit on an upside down bed. Okay? Now, the truth is, that makes, for most of us, that makes perfect sense. I mean, we could imagine that. We could imagine, it's a little cumbersome, but we could do it, right? This also gives a couple of reasons why people didn't practice it in his time. And the research I tried to do, whether successfully or not, I don't know, was to try to see what the beds looked like in the times of Tosfot. But he describes his beds, right? What does he say? He says there's Arba Kundasin, right? What are Kundasin? Four poles, right? The rich people have these beds, right, with the things. So what happens? The poles that are on top of the place where you sleep are symmetrical to the legs. Okay. So this point is, I could make a drawing of this, but I think you can figure it out. If you flip it over, right, and as if this had kundasim, four poles, right? At the four corners, this is the bed. And I turn it over, I would still be stuck with a table that has four legs and four poles on top, right? So in other words, you don't accomplish anything by flipping over the bed. An upside down bed and a right side up bed are the same thing if it's symmetrical.
The mattress, right?
So how do they have the mattress? The Gemara's bed, by the way, is the mattress is actually tied on. It's leather, right? So I don't know what type of mattresses were included in Tosa's bed. But in any case, he says that you're just as comfortable when it's flipped over as when it's right side up. So Tosfot, Kriyat Amita may have made a lot of sense in the time of the Talmud, but for us it makes no sense at all because no one can tell the difference. So why bother? Right? So says Tosfot, showing that, again, that the Takana of Chazal only applies to the animal that they were speaking about. The bed of their times, but the bed of the medieval times, or at least in medieval France, did not fit into the discussion. It was outside of this discussion, and therefore the halakha no longer applied. A couple other interesting sources, actually, should have started with Tosfot because we really went out of order. Tosfot is a Rishon, obviously, Rishonim, I should say. So already in the time of the Rishonim, change in technology was noticed. There's another interesting Tosfot in Shabbat, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, Divra Matril Tarichuta, where they speak about belts. What's the relevance of belts in Halakha? Right? It's not relevant to Shabbat, so don't try to guess from that. When do belts become relevant? In practical halakha, not just halakha of the Kohen Gadol, right? I'm sure that's what was on your mind. Sorry? Tiltul. What do you have in mind? It's wrong. I was just curious. I wanted to know. Okay. Yeah, it's not worth talking about, but it's a good guess, yeah. Tfila, yes. I thought you were going to, being Hasidic, I thought, Hasidically oriented, I thought you would catch up. Hasidim are very makbid on having a garthel, having a belt. Right, so, as with peyot, there's a halakha. Hasidim magnify the halakha, but there's a halakha of having a belt on during tefila. So, and it's actually a machloket b'zman hazeh what we do. What's the machloket? Tosfot over there says that they had to wear an actual belt. Was a belt? A belt is a rope or a piece of leather that you take and you put around yourself, right? So Tosfot, we don't do that anymore, right? Why not? Because our pants already have belts, right? In other words, I assume they didn't have elastic back then, but some sort of thing that held pants up without suspenders, right? So that took place. In other words, the point being that there was a separation, the point of the belt would seem to be to separate between different parts of the body. And if you're wearing a garment called pants as opposed to a robe that comes down from your shoulders, so that separation exists by very, very, the very virtue of wearing pants. Okay, so closely today, we don't wear pants, we don't wear belts during tefillah. There's no need to wear belts when you wear pants. Okay? In other words, that when did Chazal create such a need? You know, again, assuming it's a formal takana, formal gzirah, they did that when there was no other separation in people's clothing. But when there's another separation in people's clothing, so then such would not be necessary, says Tosfot over there.
Thinking of the clothes of the Kohanim. Mm-hmm. So they had a robe.
Right, they did, but not well. doesn't mean everybody else did. Doesn't mean everybody else did. Sorry? Okay. Sorry?
The
Kohanim had belts, right, but they also had mechnasayim. Now, her question is, if we're going to use the Kohen as the model of what they were wearing, the Kohanim also had mechnasayim. And yet they wore, right, and they also wore belts. Right? Is it, not to bring, we're not bringing a raya that since Kohanim had both, so therefore you need both, but rather, how did people dress? You know, to prove that people in the time of the Gemara also wear pants, just like in the time of Tosfot, then that would throw out his claim. His claim is, the Gemara was speaking at a time when people don't wear pants. Right? They would wear robes. And if we could prove otherwise, which is, I think was the point of the question, then would throw out their point. Yeah, okay. It'd be interesting to... I actually did the paper for him. The bed. Luckily, I got to hand it in to someone else instead, because he would probably know there wasn't a good paper. But in any case, he was a visiting professor at YU, and so once he was not visiting, as most people, most Jewish students, I handed my paper in late, so he wasn't there to see it. Anyways. Okay. One more thing very quickly, modern application. I don't want to get into it, but discussion of deaf people, of cheresh, sheino shomea ve'eino medaber, right, can't speak and can't hear, right, according to the law in the Gemara, he is not counted in a minyan, right, not if you have nine regular men without such a handicap and one with, that's not a minyan. But you have poskim in the modern period who are saying that nowadays, because the deaf person, such a deaf person is different than the deaf person was before. What's the difference? Education. Education for the deaf. Okay, you have such a tshuva in Yechavedat of Rav Vadi Yosef, Chelek Bet, Siman Vav, if you want to take a look at the discussion over there. Okay, that's the easy part of physical reality. We see that it's done, we see that it's used as a reason that certain halachot no longer apply, or perhaps are even transformed, right? In one case, we saw that we don't have to worry about a certain takana, but in the case of the deaf person, for example, it's not that we have something that's more inclusive. As we have, for the deaf person, not only can he be included, but now he has all sorts of chiyuvim. He has all sorts of obligations that he has to do. He's no longer considered someone who is disqualified from the need to do mitzvot. Right? So this is inclusive. There's situations where halacha changes to do away with certain halachot, and there are halachot that change in order to add on halachot. But everybody can understand that these type of things are entirely legitimate. Okay, where it becomes a little more complicated in physical realia is the change in nature, and they give you this whole article on Shinuye HaTeva. Shinuye HaTeva in the halachic arena is fine. It's really a no different. The bottom line is no different than the technological reality. What it comes down to is Chazal described one situation and we see a different situation, right? Since the situation is different, we say that the halacha is not applying to our current situation. Shinuye HaTeva is just an explanation as to why it's different, right? For example, discussion of in the Beit Yosef, this is on Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch. If I don't tell you which section of Shulchan Aruch I'm speaking about, Or HaChaim, which I'm doing so presently, in Shin Lamed Aleph, Siman Shin Lamed Aleph Seif Ted, you have a discussion about Shabbat, about washing a baby on the third day after it's born, after Mila. After the Mila? After the Mila, right, yeah. Sorry? After the Brit Mila. So, according to Gemara, it's a very dangerous time, and it makes sense, because that's when we see there's a danger 3 days after the Mila, like we know about Avraham Avinu, the third day, etc. In any case, the Gemara says you're allowed to be mechal Shabbat because the child's life is in danger. If you're allowed to be mechal Shabbat to wash the baby, right, to wash the baby in warm water, right?
It means if you don't have warm water, you're allowed to cook the water, right? You know, to make the fire, whatever is needed, in order to make sure the baby's life is not endangered. Why? Because the Gemara says that, in fact, the baby's life is endangered. Okay, it comes along, and this is how it's brought down, the Rishonim, comes along, the Beit Yosef, could be someone before him says this, with the famous phrase, Ha'idna, right? We've heard that phrase already before in the Sefer Torah. Ha'idna in Aramaic means what? Do you remember?
Today.
Today, right, Ha'idna, this time, right, this time period, literally, that's no longer the case. That's no longer the case. We're not allowed to do so anymore because babies don't die from not having hot water on the third day after Mila. Right? Their lives are not endangered whatsoever. Okay? What's the Beit Yosef doing, or whoever is the originator of this idea? He's saying, well, we see, you know, he's seeing, you know, people who didn't have hot water, whatever, the children are not dying. It's a common occurrence. And to be mechalal Shabbat based on something that's not true, did not feel like something that has integrity to do. Now, as one could have simply copped out and said, well, that's what the Gemara says, even though it's not the same as the reality that I see in front of me. Therefore, since the Gemara says I can be mechalal Shabbat, I'll be mechalal Shabbat. Right? Because not chilul Shabbat, because the Gemara says it's not. Or more to the point, the Gemara says I'm allowed to be mechalal Shabbat in this situation. Comes along with Beit Yosef, says that's no longer the case. Our babies don't die on the third day from lack of hot water. There are several, and as you saw a whole discussion, a whole list of things over there where such a discussion takes place. There's a Tzitz Eliezer, which I haven't found yet, because I have the wrong source for it, that speaks about the opposite, where in the Gemara it says that only certain limbs that are in danger of falling off or dying, as you will, only certain limbs are we allowed to treat on Shabbat. Again, are we allowed to mechal Shabbat in order to treat? Why? Because only certain limbs endanger a person's life. You know, losing certain limbs don't endanger life, and other limbs do endanger life. Comes along to Eliezer and says, today we see that if you're going to lose a limb, that in fact can endanger your life as a whole as well, and therefore we're allowed to be, at least according to Eliezer, we're allowed to be Mechal Shabbat for such a situation. Another interesting discussion concerning Ona, right, here is the time that a woman usually menstruates. Right, that she has to examine herself at a certain time during the month out of fear that she might menstruate on that day. So there are certain times when the Gemara says we're not worried that she normally does not menstruate, and there are other times that we say that she does. Speaks specifically in the birth cycle, in the first 3 months when she's pregnant, the Gemara assumes that she can still menstruate, right, the first 3 months. When in fact, today, as soon as one becomes pregnant, the menstruation, 99.9% of the times, stops right away. Okay, so this 3 month business is not really correct according to what we see. Similarly, the Gemara speaks about women not menstruating for 24 months after giving birth, whether they nurse or not, even though the assumption was that they would nurse. Generally speaking, in fact, today that's not generally the case, that women menstruate even when they're nursing. I mean, it's usually a several months hiatus after they give birth, but 24 months is almost unheard of. In any case, there are halachot that relate to this. Most poskim do not pay attention in this particular case to the physical realia. The one exception that I saw, there may be others, is the Igrot Moshe. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein, interesting tshuva in Yirat Deah, Chelek Gimel. Right? He breaks up his tshuvot into different sections. Siman Nun Bet, section Aleph, section 1. Okay, so you can. He actually cites earlier authorities who said similar thing. There's a tshuvot of the Bach. That was the famous commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Beit Chadash, as well as the Noda B'Yehuda, who lived several hundred years ago in Germany, was one of the major poskim of Europe. But there are those who disagree with Rav Moshe.
So what was he saying?
He was saying that, in fact, a woman does not need to check herself on the first 3 months as soon as she knows she's pregnant. Right? Lamaaseh is interesting. Tshuva, he doesn't go that far. He says, better to be machmir anyways, because all sorts of people disagree with me. But b'diavad, it's not a problem. Again, the ramifications are not really so important for our discussion right now. There's another example I want to bring, a fascinating example, which actually more fits into the other topic, which is the change in technology, and that has to do with a fetus, or a child, if you will, that's born after 8 months of pregnancy. So there again, the Gemara says that an 8 month old child will necessarily die, has no chances of survival. So the 7th month child and 9th month child, a 9 month child is obvious that that's what we expect, but it says that a 7th month child has better chances of survival, or I should say, has chances of survival, whereas an 8 month does not have such chances. By the way, biologically, the 7 month old baby does have an advantage over the 8 month old baby in terms of what's developed and what's not developed. Apparently, the 8th month is a more critical time period, but that's not the point. The point is that in our time, that's not really the situation. Why is it not the situation? So there's a Tshuva, the Shevet HaLevi, and he speaks about medical technology, and specifically the incubators that they have. He speaks a lot about that, and he says that, you know, what the Gemara says is true, that, or at least may be true, that eight month old children would not survive, but today medical technology allow us to keep them around and to heal them from their problems, and they are able to live normal and full lives. Now, what's the difference with Nafkamina? So it's a very important difference. Fascinating discussion, actually. The Gemara says that such a baby who only has a month to live at most is not someone you can be Mechalel Shabbat for. Right? If that's shocking, we should just put it into context that for a non-Jew, in theory, right, not in practice, but in theory also in the time of the Gemara, you're not supposed to be Mechalel Shabbat, right, for an adult non-Jew. So, in other words, breaking Shabbat is not as simple a thing as we think it is. But that's an aside. It's not really the discussion of the day. We're speaking more in a different context. Be that as it may, the halacha and the Gemara is that you're not, if you know a child's only completed 8 months, you're not allowed to save its life on Shabbat. If it involves Doraita prohibitions. Even if it's and taking care of it, nursing such a child, the Gemara allows a mother to nurse such a child, but not to touch it. Not to carry, not to bring it to her, because the child is considered muksa. It's considered, the term in the Gemara is that it's like a stone, that such a child is like a stone. Again, whether you like the halacha or not, it's not really relevant right now. What's important is that was the halacha back then. What was it based on? It was based on that all the observation of the rabbis of the time, that all such babies would die very soon after they were born. Okay? Comes along Shevet HaLevi, he's followed by Shemer Shabbat and Rabbi Avadi Yosef and others, who say that today that's not the case. You're Mechalel Shabbat for such a child. Why? Because the technology is different. But let's go back to the other cases. The other cases, what the Poskim said, is not that the technology changed, but rather that people changed. Or in certain cases, animals changed. Right? The Klal of Mishtane Ateva. Their nature is different. Right? Which is a difficult concept scientifically. In other words, 2,000 years is a short time in the annals of evolution to say there are many major changes that transpire. That's not to say that there are no changes. Certainly, there have been changes in all sorts of physiological phenomenon, but some of the changes that are ascribed to simply times being different are very difficult, to say the least, to explain on a scientific level, and scientifically simply don't hold water. But be that as it may, again, what we're looking for from our perspective, is if I was Rabbi Slifkin and I had to deal with the issue of science versus Torah, it'd be a whole different discussion. But from our perspective as poskim, ultimately what you have is very similar discussion to what we were talking about before, the candles and the belt. What we're talking about is we look at society the way it is now, we look at the halakha, and we see the halakha doesn't apply to the reality we have in front of us. Therefore, the rabbis, even if they made such a law, never had in mind that it would be on these things. And therefore, the law simply is not on the books for these things. It's on the books if ever we were to revert back to the same reality. If children, right, to take a very crass example, if 8-month-old children were to die, we would be stuck with that halakha on the books, at least, unless we could find any other way out. But since the reality is different, we don't have to worry about it. It simply doesn't apply.
Is there not a possibility that the reasons why they changed that and found the justification is because people actually didn't keep these halachot?
Yeah, right. So that's something we're going to discuss again before in the next session. What motivates rabbis to push in this direction, and when are they not motivated to push in those directions? Certainly Minhag is as we saw in Rav Moshe, I mentioned after class, I said two things. I'm sort of jumping the gun, but I didn't want to talk about it, but since you asked, we saw two things that motivated Rav Moshe in his tshuva. One is that people were already doing it, already drinking milk that was commercial on the market. And the other one was that there was a need for it. People who were in outlying communities couldn't get otherwise kosher milk. But we'll get more to that in the coming weeks. Because the other area, which is much more complicated, I don't know if you notice, Professor Steinberg sort of darts around it and says, I'm not going to discuss it. I'm not going to discuss where the shinoi is not in the nature of objects, but is in the nature of society, right? Shinuye chevratiim, right? Social changes. Right? Society is different, right? What's the difference? Why should it be any more complicated? You see, society is different than it was back then. So it's the same thing, that the organ is not the same, the candle is not the same, and society is not the same. What's the difference? I think that there are a couple of things, but maybe someone would like to suggest something. Well, why poskim more reticent, or why is it more controversial?
Well, it's not really clear if it's a real change or not. Like, I think Rav Moshe was testing that men and women can sit on a committee together, which in the past would have been a big breach of modesty.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that today men and women are just more accustomed,
right,
to speaking to one another and socially intermingling in an appropriate fashion. And therefore it's not distracting to the men and so on and so forth.
Right.
But maybe that's just this one society and just like this one time, and maybe they really shouldn't be doing that. And I think Rav Moshe actually says, I'm not really sure how this came about, and kind of implied he doesn't really care for it, but this is the reality, so given that's the reality, so the reality could revert back in the other way also.
Right, but if he were to accept that this is the reality, and then he could say, for our society here, in fact, I think that's the avenue we're traveling. We're saying that a posek is identifying the criteria of his society. We'll see, I don't know if you saw in the 3-day Eish, about women and men, boys and girls singing together in youth groups.
Right?
So he speaks about a certain society, and people have pointed out, well, that applied to his society, and perhaps not in, certainly not in Mea Shearim, but even in contemporary Israel, where things, you know, for example, our youth groups, many of the youth groups are completely separate nowadays. So, you know, it's the same reality. If the posek spells out what his tshuva is based upon, so he's not being asked to judge for all of history. He's only being asked to judge for his community. If he spells out why his community is different, then there's no reason for him to worry that some other community is going to borrow, misappropriate that. The tshuva, Rafi, what would you want to say?
On the other side, in terms of the, I guess, the pro for societal change, causing a precedent for halakhic change,
Sekhara Sheham Noa Medo. So take out the love or tzibu, if it's the karma that's made, that can be changed in a situation where they see that the society is not able to withstand it, or not that the karma doesn't fit the society.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's that, you know, framework built into the system that I can therefore apply with.
Right, but the question is, why hesitate? Why hesitate in looking at society? You know, as we see more hesitation, more restraint, certainly more controversy around situations where folks can say society is different. Well, let's go through a couple of examples, then people might have a better idea of why some people feel this is dangerous or should be avoided. Firstly, what we see in the Rishonim, I gave you a Mishnah in Brachot, my famous Mishnah, we're talking about weddings previous among the seminar in the first hour, those who were here, right, over there it says Chatan Patur Mikriyat Shema, right, the first night, or it could be for several days in certain situations, right, a Chatan need not say Kriyat Shema, right, is he allowed to? So that's not so clear either. When it says Patur sometimes means you don't have to. In some situations, it means it's a good idea not to do so. It's not so important for our purposes. What's important is the psak of Tosafot. Tosafot say that, you know what, today, Chatanim should say Kriyat Shema. What kind of business is that? The rabbis, my wife asked me today about a psak of the Rambam that seemed to go against the Gemara. So she asked me, is it possible the Rambam disagrees with the Gemara? Right? So anybody who has the Yeshiva background knows that Rishonim don't disagree with the Gemara. That's not how you play the game. So Tosafot didn't disagree with the Gemara. They agree with the Gemara. Yet they're telling us the halacha is different than the Gemara. What's their justification? Societal change. The issue of Kavanah. People in the old days used to have Kavanah. Today, we don't have Kavanah. If Kavanah is an issue, a nervous Chatan is not going to be able to have Kavanah. So why bother him with Kriyat Shema? It's just an impediment, right? A normal person will have Kavanah. So therefore, they have to do Kriyat Shema. But when a normal person also doesn't have Kavanah, so there's no difference between the nervous Chatan and everybody else in terms of Kriyat Shema. Right? Nobody has Kavanah, so say, go through the ritual. Now, we spoke about this issue before, the halachic ritualization of prayer. Fascinating topic. I think we have an essay on our website about it that I wrote at the time. But in any case, Tosafot looks at society and says, you know, society is different. They thought that people had Kavanah during Kriyat Shema. Forget about it. That's not what goes on today. Therefore, there's no reason that the Ptur can't apply. After all, the Ptur is preventing someone from doing a mitzvah d'oraita. Saying Kriyat Shema is one of the few mitzvot min haTorah that we do on a daily basis. And if we're on an even keel, if a chatan is on an even keel as everyone else, there's no reason to prevent him from performing that mitzvah. By the way, this issue of not having kavanah has other ramifications in halakha. Some of you might know that if you don't have Kavanah, according to the classical poskim, as the Rishonim, you're supposed to go back. Certainly, if you miss the first bracha, right? And if you don't have Kavanah for the first bracha, bracha v'avot, so fairly well-known halakha that you have to have Kavanah for that paragraph. What if you don't, right? So Shulchan Aruch says that you go back, right? Comes along the Ramah, quoting the Tur, right, saying that, no, you don't go back. Why don't you go back? Same principle that was invoked by Tosafot. You didn't have Kavanah the first time. Who says you're going to have the Kavanah the second time? Forget about it. Go on and take care of the rest of the things that you have on your agenda. Right? Simply not going to happen, say the Tosafot. We're not living in the reality, in the time period, where people have Kavanah. Again, what does that mean? Lemaaseh may not mean what we think, that you have absolutely no idea where you are and what you're doing, but it means that you don't have the appropriate Kavanah, and without that appropriate Kavanah, you may as well at least perform the ritual. But in any case, that's that's in the Rishonim in terms of halacha, very serious halacha of both tefillah and kriyat shema. In the Achronim, you have some more interesting situations. The Sri De'esh that I didn't have it in the Marmakomot, but I didn't expect you to read it. The famous tshuva, it's a couple of famous tshuvot, actually, they're relevant. One is about bat mitzvah, where he allows the practice of bat mitzvah. But the tshuva that is more famously quoted, it's a wonderful tshuva, and everybody should try to read it in its entirety. It's Siman Chet in the Sri De'esh. That's Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, who lived in, he was born in Eastern Europe, moved to Germany, was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, and accepted the Torah Derech Eretz approach to Torah, to Jewish life. And as a result, after World War II, became a very lonely individual. He had a small yeshiva in Switzerland, thought about coming to Israel, but couldn't really find his place here because he saw that there was no continuation of that approach on a serious level. In any case, in this tshuva, he's asked about a French youth group. He's asked about the whole... sounding very similar to NCSY, for those of you who have American background. I suppose Bnei Akiva, certainly Bnei Akiva of 30, 40, 50 years ago. And they ask him whether they should have the group to begin with, but more particularly whether it's permissible for boys and girls to be singing together, or more to the point, whether girls should be singing at all in this youth group. And again, he speaks about all sorts of issues, including Kol Isha. The point that I want to draw out is that the bottom line, Sri De'esh says you can go both ways, but since women or girls in Western culture, meaning France and Germany, 19th century France and Germany, will be insulted by not being allowed to sing, so it looks like we need to move in that direction. Meaning, when did the rabbis, if they had such a prohibition of women singing in this context, and he says perhaps they didn't really have such an idea in mind to begin with, but if they did, perhaps it would not apply in such a culture. In such a culture, women insulted by such a prohibition in this context. Again, the context is very limited. Some people make a mistake with this tshuva. The context is for I don't know if kiruv is the right word, more to strengthen Jewish life in a mixed setting. It was not for meaning everyone singing together in such a context. He's also speaking about Jewish songs, which presumably were Zmirot and the like, primarily. So that's the context that he's speaking about. He says in that context, it could be that the rabbis, he doesn't really frame it in those terms, but essentially he comes to his final decision based on that criteria, and the criteria that women in that time and place would be insulted. Yeah.
Just have a question.
Yeah.
Do you know of any, like, are there any criteria or principles given that I guess, and not Chazal, but Achronim, could use to justify these changes? Because it seems like the example that you just gave,
again, we're going to speak about methodology more in the next couple of weeks. But one bottom line principle is there has to be halachic justification for it. In other words, just saying the women are insulted, so therefore we're going to do away with halacha doesn't go right. Or any, you know, the society has changed, so therefore you have to know the system and how it works and find a legal... And it's just like a lawyer has to prepare a brief, there has to be a brief prepared.
So in this example, what was the...
So again, there's discussion of whether the whole prohibition applies to holy songs, whether there's a Gemara in Megillah that when two voices... But this is a problem in Kiddush, especially with rambunctious kids, that two voices can't be heard when they're singing together. Right? Why am I saying rambunctious kid? If someone's making kiddush and there's a rambunctious kid also talking, singing, carrying on, you may not have been you'll say the mitzvah of kiddush, except if you were the one saying it. But anybody who was hearing you may not have been halachically able to hear you, which creates a problem. But be that as it may, those are some of the criteria that he presents. Yeah, Rafi. Yeah, we're going to speak about that. Hold on to that question. If I haven't answered it in another 2 weeks' time, but I will. It's on the agenda. It's on the agenda. One more example, and then perhaps we'll ask the question again before we get into a more controversial question, which we'll save for next week. It's a cute little tshuva tucked away at the end of the Minchat Shlomo. The Minchat Shlomo is Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, right, famous posek here in Yerushalayim. Known for his tremendous Derech Eretz, among other things, and his sense of Shikul Adat, of knowing what's more important, what's less important, which is going to be one of the critical criteria of proper Psak, is sort of dealing with all sorts of issues at the same time and determining what's more critical and what's less critical. It's really... So, yeah, to have common sense, but it's common sense and much more. That's a necessary, but not exclusive ingredient.
Common sense should be
right. That's right. It's not so simple. But in any case, he speaks about walking behind a woman. I don't know how many people realize that that's prohibited for a man. Right? If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, Evna Ezer, and Chaf Aleph, Siman Chaf Aleph, Seif Vav, you'll see that's prohibited. Right? So the Minchat Shlomo was asked whether perhaps it's different today, and he says that it may be different for two reasons. He says that number one, the lashon of the Shulchan Aruch is Misha Paga Isha Beshuk. If you happen to chance to meet a woman in the Shuk, you can't follow her. You can't walk behind her. You have to find a different way. Go a walk in front of her, whatever it is. I mean, perhaps not so obvious, but the reason is that a person shouldn't stare at the woman and come to lewd thoughts. That's the reason it's prohibited. So the Minchat Shlomo says that, first of all, in the time, he speculates, but he says that in earlier times there weren't so many women out in the public area, and therefore if you passed one woman up, you wouldn't see any other woman, so you wouldn't have the problem. He says today, you pass up one woman, you're behind another, so you're not really accomplishing anything by trying not to walk behind women, except like becoming very dizzy, walking very fast. I don't know what to return. Anyways, he says that's one issue, and he says the other issue is that the again, assuming it was some sort of takana, the rabbis only had this in mind when a person would be embarrassed to stare at a woman straight on. In other words, they wouldn't be embarrassed if they were behind the woman, but they'd be embarrassed if they were standing in front of her. He says that doesn't necessarily apply so much today. The people that would stare from behind would also stare from in front, and therefore the halakha, he says, at least if there's a shad sorech, if it's a mitzvah to walk in a certain order, right? You don't want to push someone in front of you, or he says for nimusim, and typical Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach fashion, if it's polite to stand in line where you are, as opposed to saying, there's a halacha and Shulchan Aruch Evan Ezer, I have to walk in front of you in line, I can't stand behind you. So in such situations, says Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, our society is different. There are some social changes that have taken place, which made the original takana, if it was that, again, we almost never know if anything's a takana, but even if it was a takana, I'm putting that in parentheses, right? Most of the post-game don't really discuss it explicitly, but even if it was a takana, the takana would not apply to a society that acts in the way our society acts. Or simply is situated in such a way as our society is situated. There are many other tshuvot. We're just giving a few examples. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of another circumstance in which you apparently didn't feel the things had changed sufficiently, or that other things overrode it. Mm-hmm. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if I'm not mistaken, was posted for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, but the husband could not be in the delivery room.
Right.
Despite all the Lamaze courses, despite all the Ra, the husband's just putting a baseball cap and his wife on today and the whole works, so that either he felt it was so inappropriate that he'd be there, or he didn't recognize this as a societal change, because it's clearly a societal change.
Yeah, again, societal change is one issue. That doesn't mean it puts off all halachot. I'm not sure. In other words, if I was in his situation, the fact that society is somewhat looser about mingling of the sexes would automatically... So, halachot v'kama v'kama may not be an issue there. I mean, presumably... Okay, but so... Correct, but it's a different societal issue than what he's talking about. Maybe related... But it's not necessarily the exact same thing, and the situation is in fact different. But we're running out of time, so I'm not going to ask the question. I'll have you think about it as to why we're more squeamish about. I missed the most important source, the Meiri. Let me just at least give you the Meiri very quickly. Famous Meiri, one place that it's found is in Baba Kama, Lamed. Was it Gimel? What I put down. What is the sources? Lamed Vav on Bet. Lamed Vav on Bet. Right? There are certain halachot that allow us to treat non-Jews in ways that could be described as unfair. For example, if our ox gores damage their property, a Jew is not responsible. If we find their lost object, we don't have to give it back to them. If they forget about a loan, we don't have to remind them. All these are, again, a very interesting discussion, not for tonight, and not for next week either, because it's not really my topic. But what the Meiri says is that these laws were meant for a different type of non-Jews who were not cultured and not moral. Moral is really the critical issue. He says when we're talking about Christians and Muslims, he doesn't use those words. He says, Umot HaGduhot, what is a famous expression? Amim She'enam, Amim She'gduhim, B'dachei Datot V'nimusim. Okay? Nations that are fenced in by the ways of religion and what's nimus? We said derech eretz, right? Good translation of nimus. Manners, right? So civilized nations, right? It does not apply to such nations, right? Rishon. We're not talking about Pronim, we're talking about Rishon, someone very early. Generally not accepted in halacha, though some poskim, such as the Maral and Rav Kook, did accept this halacha. Society that the rabbis were speaking about was a different society, and they allowed us to treat non-Jews in certain ways that would seem discriminatory, that was relevant to their society. It's not relevant to a different situation where people are acting, where non-Jews are acting in moral ways. Okay, as I said before, this category of social change, we're more careful about it. I want you to think about why we're more careful about it. We really didn't put the reason on the table. Because until we do that, we're not going to be able to look at the next issue, which is the issue where it's only going to be, because we don't have a lot of time, it's only going to be a few minutes at the beginning of next class, and that's the issue of women's aliyot. There's a lot of discussion in the last 10 years, especially about women getting aliyot, based on the whole idea, primarily, of social change, that when the rabbis said that women should not be getting aliyot, as basically they do in the Gemara, they didn't have a society like ours in mind. There are many other reasons why, but our focus is going to be on that. There are many other defenses given, but we're going to look at that. But before we know to what extent this is something we can use or not use, we need to look and to think about what the problem might be. I'm going to give you a handout again from Rav Lichtenstein.
I wanted to ask you one question. I don't know if you want to go into this now, not now, but have you seen anywhere that Poskim will say, since the moral criteria of the non-Jewish world have changed, therefore we also need to change them? For example, if you could take the extreme case of the baby of 7 months,
mm-hmm.
So of the halakha, we consider the baby to be like a stone. Yes. To us, this is obviously morally highly problematic. Is any posek ever coming up and saying, well, we can no longer sell this, let's say, to the community, because A, it is in the non-Jewish world, this is no longer accepted. Not because of the question if it is really true, yes or no, but the fact that we are not trying to keep that baby alive, is this at all, in other words, is the independent moral issue also at work in the halachic system here?
Yeah. I'm not going to. First of all, I don't have much of an answer, but as far as ethics, I think it's very difficult for Postum to say that ethics have changed. It's a radical concept. We see a little bit in Rav Kook. I don't know to what extent anyone's going to use it.
Because it could become in Chilul Hashem as well. Let's say that the moral standards of the Jewish, non-Jewish world has put it to a house, and we are behind them.
But for a posek to accept such an idea is very far-reaching. I think it's a very radical statement.
Discuss something like that.
There's two quotes about Chilul Shabbat
for non-Jews. Yeah. But again, I think that's rooted in Jewish ethics. It's a whole discussion. I haven't seen the short of the answer is that I haven't seen, and we can look at it further. I gave you the source. Okay, so I guess that's it.